Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. A true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about Ben and Freya Pedersen, the last two victims of the Hyde Park bombing. And yet their faces don't appear in any photos, their names aren't etched on the memorial plaque, and although they died 30 years after this terrorist attack, their deaths are no less tragic. Murder Mile is researched using original and authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 64, Ben and Freya Pedersen, the last victims of the Hyde Park bombing. Today, I'm standing on South Carriage Drive in Hyde Park, W2. A short walk south of Maison Lyonnaise, where Evelyn Hamilton met the Blackout Ripper, a brisk dawdle east of the Milk Bar, where Rita Nelson met Reg Christie, a quick canter from the Tyburn Tree, London's infamous execution site, and a short dawdle from the ice disaster on the Serpentine, coming soon to Murder Mile. Situated west of Mayfair, and bookended by Bayswater and Kensington, Hyde Park is the largest of London's four royal parks. Established in 1536, when fat-bloated wife shortener Henry VIII nabbed 350 acres of the church's land to turn a deer reserve into a shooting gallery, Hyde Park is a public park, open to everyone for everything, from concerts to protests, sports to picnics, fairs to free speech. Hyde Park is a real blessing in a smoggy metropolis like London, as although it's circled by belching buses, honking horns, and speed-crazy psychopaths on scooters, racing to get a hot cup of coffee to some asshole with an app, too lazy to get it themselves, in a city where there's a Costa and a Starbucks every 10 feet. Being full of grass, trees, birds, and a lake, Hyde Park is literally a breath of fresh air. Of course, its tranquility is often sullied by half-wits in hammocks, joggers squatting with sweaty bum cracks, utter twats playing tinny tunes on iPhones, bag-handed bastards picking up their dog plop only to hang it from a tree like it's a freaking Christmas treat, also known as the shit Santa. And of course, there's babies. Really, what is the point to them? All they do is cry and crap. Ugh. Skirting the south side of Hyde Park, South Carriage Drive is a two-lane street between Exhibition Road and Hyde Park. Lined with trees, a horse track, and Hyde Park barracks, it's always quiet, as cars cannot stop or park here, and for good reason. And although a memorial commemorates the dead, with very few people knowing their story, there is no plaque for Ben and Freya Pedersen. As it was here, on Tuesday the 20th of July 1982, that one of Britain's worst mainland bombings took place, And yet 30 years later, Hyde Park would claim its last two victims. ...1982 was a bad year. Being at the tail end of a recession, with 3 million people unemployed, inflation high, wages low, and crime soaring. As Margaret Thatcher entered her fourth year as British Prime Minister, Britain was at war with Argentina, and the 1979 ceasefire with the Provisional Irish Republican Army had collapsed. Seeing itself as a successor to the original IRA, who sought to end British rule in Northern Ireland, the Provisional IRA was the most active Republican paramilitary group of the conflict, killing more than 1,800 people in its 30-year campaign. In the 2 years since the ceasefire collapsed, in London alone, the IRA detonated 7 bombs, injuring 65 people and killing 12. On the 2nd of December 1980, 5 people died at a Territorial Army recruitment centre in Kensington. 8th of January 1981, 50 musicians escaped an explosion at RAF Uxbridge. 17th of October 1981, Lieutenant General Sir Stuart Pringle lost a leg when a booby-trapped bomb blew up under his car. 26th of October 1981, Kenneth Howarth was killed when he tried to defuse a bomb left in a Wimpy bar on Oxford Street. And on the 23rd of November 1981, a soldier's wife and her friend were injured when a bomb, disguised as a toy gun, exploded outside the Royal Artillery Barracks, next to a school for the Army's children. In a campaign which was both targeted and random, sometimes the IRA gave warnings, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes a blast was just a distraction to cause the panicked people to run in the direction of a bigger bomb. And with devices left in bags, on buses, or in bins near busy shopping districts, the victims were both servicemen and civilians, whether men, women, or children. And the next bomb was no exception. On Saturday, the 10th of October 1981, at 12 p.m, as a small white coach carrying 23 soldiers turned onto St. Barnabas Street, the bomb exploded. Hidden in a parked laundry van, detonated by remote, packed full of 8 kilos of highly explosive gelignite and being padded with bags of 4-inch nails, although the blast was strong enough to eviscerate the van, as the bus wasn't close enough, the initial explosion missed its target. But as the blast wave turned these harmless steel nails into thousands of high-speed projectiles, which could penetrate metal, wood, bone, and skin, 40 people were injured, 8 seriously, and 2 were killed. 59-year-old Nora Field and 18-year-old John Breslin, 2 innocent civilians who happened to be passing. And yet, little would the British security services know that the bombing at the Chelsea Barracks was just a dress rehearsal for the true horror that was still to come at Hyde Park. In a plain, red-bricked, but oddly shaped 6-story building sat alone on South Carriage Drive, with 10-foot-high walls, a thick reinforced gate, and a large Union Jack flag proudly flying. Although it looked like a tacky 1980s hotel, with a faint whiff of dung, a discreet whinny of horses, and a large military insignia, this is the garrison of the Household Cavalry Mounted Regiment, the Queen's official bodyguards. Comprised of the British Army's 2 most senior regiments, the Life Guards and the Blues and Royals, the Household Cavalry performs the changing of the guard, a ceremonial tradition dating back 360 years. And on alternate days, with the Life Guards in red tunics, gold plumes and gold body armour, and the Blues and Royals in dark blue tunics, red plumes and silver body armour, they ride with absolute precision, on neat and unfazed horses, from Hyde Park Barracks, down South Carriage Drive and Constitution Hill, changing at Buckingham Palace, and Horse Guards Parade. As a consummate soldier, who was fastidiously neat, precise and professional, for 21-year-old Michael Peterson, being a sergeant in the Blues and Royals was an honour. Up early, to black his boots, starch his creases and polish his body armour to a mirror shine. With his face clean shaven and his brown hair neatly trimmed to military regulation, Michael took pride in his duties. Trained to tackle the unexpected in an unemotional way, showing no weakness or fear, although he had a fun and gregarious side, Michael was the perfect soldier. He was smart, loyal, and serious about every detail in his life, as in his eyes, everything had to be perfect, and that included his horse. Bred as a cross between an Irish draft mare and a thoroughbred stallion, with silky black hair, a broad, powerful body, and standing 16 hands tall, Sefton was an impressive sight. Unlike Michael, Sefton had already served in the British Army for 15 years. But just like Michael, although strong, sturdy, and unshakable, off duty he had a temperamental side. With Sefton disobeying orders and breaking rank, Hensy was given the nickname Sharky. As to those he didn't like, he would bite. At exactly 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday the 20th of July 1982, as the double gates of Hyde Park Barracks opened, in 2x2 formation, the Blues and Royals trotted out and turned right onto South Carriage Drive. Being mid-morning, the street was quiet, the park was empty and the traffic was light. So except for a handful of tourists and a few parked cars, the road was silent. As per usual, the route was routine, and as the troop passed a low depression in the road, rising up towards Hyde Park Corner, everything seemed ordinary. From the clip-clop of the horses' hooves, to the faint rustle of the summer leaves, to the distant click of cameras, as a small, excitable crowd gathered, unaware that they were trotting into a trap. On the night prior, the Provisional IRA had stolen a plain-looking car, which by the morning had yet to be reported missing. Parking it up on South Carriage Drive, and having fed the meter with new 20-pence pieces, the rather ordinary blue Austin Morris Marina blended in with the other parked-up Minis and VWs. The horses and riders thought nothing of it as they passed the little blue car. But hidden inside its boot was a remote detonator, 11 kilos of gelignite, and 14 kilos of 4-inch steel nails. At 10:40 a.m., the nail bomb exploded. The flash was an intense yellow, burning bright but fading fast. As with the bulk of the blast insulated by its metal boot, the explosives tossed the Austin Marina into the air, flipping it onto the car behind, a ragged tangled mess of twisted smoking metal. With ears ringing, an eerie silence descended as the disorientated spectators stirred, their world enveloped by a cacophony of sounds, as the blast wave smashed windows streets away, sirens wailed and horses whinnied, as slowly began the screams. Thick with black caustic smoke, as the stench of chemicals and burning drifted from the fiery wreckage, although they could hear the fear, no one could see what had happened, as the street was shielded in a cloud of acrid dust and smoking debris. But as a light wind blew, the dark clouds parted. Both lanes of South Carriage Drive were a sea of blood, as side by side, soldiers and stallions lay dead or dying. The dull grey road littered with black shapeless lumps as injured horses oozed red slicks, and underneath these crippled beasts, with shiny armour oddly glinting, their bloodied riders lay trapped. As before, it wasn't the explosives which killed or injured, but with 80 nails per bag, the blast wave turned 14 transparent bags of harmless pins into 900 lethal steel projectiles, which whizzed through the air like thin silver bullets, piercing skin, shredding muscle, and embedding in bone. As a strong and sturdy horse, Sergeant Peterson later stated that Sefton acted so professionally that even as the bomb exploded, he as the rider wasn't thrown. And although Sefton bled profusely, with 4-inch nails having ruptured its left eye, jugular vein, and embedded in 34 parts of its body, the injured horse galloped to the barracks, taking its rider to safety. Sergeant Peterson was miraculously unharmed. The blast and shrapnel shielded by his horse, and his vital organs protected by his body armor. But having witnessed a sight of absolute horror, being too traumatized to even talk, Sergeant Peterson remained in a severe shock. The nail bomb injured all 16 of the horses. 9 along with Sefton were wounded. But with 7 being so badly maimed, they would never have survived. Under several dark tarpaulins, the regiment's vet ended their suffering. They were Cedric, Epaulette, Falcon, Rochester, Waterford, Yeastvit, and Zara. 22 people were admitted to hospital. 18 soldiers, 1 policeman, and 3 civilians. One of whom was a mother and her baby. And although the standard bearer of the Blues and Royals fought on, 3 days later, he died of his wounds and became the 4th human casualty of the Hyde Park bombing. Those we lost were Corporal Major Roy Bright, Lieutenant Anthony Daly, Trooper Simon Tipper, and Lance Corporal Jeffrey Young. Two hours later, at 12:55 p.m., 2 miles north in Regent's Park, as 30 members of the Royal Green Jackets performed hits from the musical Oliver, a second bomb exploded, injuring 8 and killing 7. The events of Tuesday the 20th of July 1982 brought a country to a standstill. And although many servicemen survived, still living in an era of the British stiff upper lip, where a trained soldier never shows fear, and real men supposedly never show weakness, the worst injuries weren't always physical or even visible. As the beloved children of Sergeant Peterson, thankfully, Ben and Freya weren't there that day, as being barely a young unmarried man himself, they wouldn't be born for at least another 2 decades. But the horror of the Hyde Park bombing, even 30 years later, would affect their lives forever. With every newspaper carrying the same photo, the sight of 7 dead horses strewn across a London street sparked a furious fire under the British people. And with Margaret Thatcher condemning their actions as callous and cowardly crimes committed by evil, brutal men who know nothing of democracy, although Irish Americans had openly supported the IRA, the bombing had backfired and their US funding began to cease. That day, given only a 50-50 chance of survival, Sefton underwent an 8-hour operation to save its life. And being a strong-willed, stubborn horse, as donations flooded in, against the odds, Sefton survived. And as an act of defiance against these cowardly terrorists who had hid in the shadows, detonated bombs from a distance, and indiscriminately killed and injured men, women, and children, the next day, the Household Cavalry performed the changing of the guard, passing the same spot where their comrades had fallen. To this day, a memorial stands, and as they pass, they honour it with eyes left and swords drawn. A few months later, both Sergeant Peterson and Sefton returned to the Hyde Park barracks and back to active service. as although they were physically and mentally scarred, they were both soldiers. As a symbol of courage, triumph, and British pluck, having won the British people's hearts, alongside his rider, Sefton was awarded the prestigious title of Horse of the Year, and they both became national celebrities, receiving standing ovations wherever they went. After two more years of service, in August 1984, Sefton retired. But owing to an incurable lameness in his legs, caused by his injuries, on the 9th of July 1993, aged 30, Sefton was put to sleep. He was buried with military honours, and a life-size statue of Sefton was unveiled at the Royal Veterinary College, with a medical wing in his name. Sefton lived like a soldier, died like a fighter, was treated like a hero, and was buried with honours. But serious injuries aren't always obvious, and although physically Michael Pederson had survived, mentally he was battle-scarred and bleeding. But he wasn't the last casualty of the Hyde Park bombing. 1 year later, Michael married his girlfriend Susan Day, and they had two babies together. As a doting father, described as a lovely man who would help anyone out if they had a problem, after 21 years with the British Army, he completed his full military service and retired in 2001. After nearly a quarter of a century of strict rules, bellowed orders, and starched shirts, life outside of the army was difficult to adjust to. The world was too sloppy and disorganized for a neat, precise man who liked things done his way or not at all. And sadly, that year, his marriage to Susan ended in divorce. Taught to bottle his feelings, hide his anxiety, and disguise his depression, battling endless nightmares and survivor's guilt, in a rare moment of vulnerability, Michael admitted to his doctor that he thought he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. But being too proud, he didn't get help. In 2002, Michael married his second wife, Erica. He retrained as a lorry driver. Together they ran a successful haulage company called High Road Logistics, and having moved into a lovely red-bricked cottage in Ashford, Kent, the couple had two lovely children, who they named Ben and Freya. Life was good, or so it seemed. Seen by neighbours as a gentle giant, who loved his kids and wouldn't do anything to harm them, although 7-year-old Ben and 6-year-old Freya seemed neat, happy, and polite, Michael could be very controlling, overbearing, and a bully. And being jealous of his wife, the marriage was rocky. The end began so innocently. On Saturday, the 25th of August 2012, Michael and Erica Pederson were invited to an army reunion. Having both had one too many drinks, Michael saw Erica briefly being kissed by another man. The couple argued, they fought, and allegedly being pushed, Erica sustained a broken arm and shoulder. A few days later, Michael posted on Facebook,
"The worst day of my life. Sadly, I've split with Erica. I'm absolutely distraught."
But the marriage was over. The assault was one step too far, and as Erica began divorce proceedings, Michael was served with an injunction banning him from the family home. His very precise and regimented life was falling apart, and for the first time, he had no control. On Sunday, the 30th of September 2012, as part of a pre-arranged visit by his soon-to-be ex-wife, Michael took Ben and Freya to visit their grandfather in Andover, Hampshire. They had lunch, they played, they paddled in the lake, and as promised, he would drop them back to the family home by 5 p.m. By 7 p.m., with her calls going unanswered, no sign of Michael or the kids, her house having been ransacked and two chef's knives missing from the kitchen. Erica called the police, but it was too late. At 6:15 p.m., in the nearby village of Newton Stacey, a local dog walker strolled down a secluded country lane. Seeing a blue Saab 900 convertible parked up and blocking the bridle way, with the engine off, the lights out, and no one inside, as the dog walker skirted down the sides, at the back, by the boot, they found Ben, Freya, and Michael. As much as he loved his children, he could never be apart from them. And with no traces of drugs or alcohol in his system, Michael had inflicted his final act of control against his wife. The attack was frenzied, violent, and terrifying. As having been treated to a last day out, the two tiny children stood, their tears ignored, their screams unheard. As wielding two large silver knives, a 6-foot soldier stabbed them one by one. Only this wasn't a crazed stranger. This was their daddy. Struggling to fight off their attacker, both children sustained deep slashes to their arms and hands. But being no match for a man 5 times their size, 7-year-old Ben was stabbed 6 times in the chest, the 8-inch blade left sticking out and bolt upright. With a second knife, he stabbed 6-year-old Freya in the heart, severing a major artery which bled down her pretty pink top and leggings. And as both of his babies lay dead, Michael Peterson plunged the knife 3 times into his own chest. Hundreds of mourners turned out for the service at St. Saviour's Church. With the pews lined with pink and blue balloons, a sermon by the vicar who had baptized them both, a reading from Freya's favourite book, The Gruffalo, and the hall, ringing to the tune of The Circle of Life, a song from the Disney's Lion King. On a large screen beamed the smiling faces of Ben and Freya, a big brother and his baby sister, hugging during happier times, with Ben dressed as a racing driver and Freya as a little fairy. At the inquest, the coroner recorded a verdict of death by suicide and 2 counts of unlawful killing. Being born almost 1/4 century after the 1982 bombing, which had traumatized their father, it's still uncertain today whether Michael's actions were a consequence of those events, or his need for precision and control. Unable to cope in an undisciplined world, away from the British Army. Many people died that day in Hyde Park and Regent's Park. Many were injured, both servicemen and civilians, humans and equine. And up until the 1997 ceasefire, which still holds today, in a bloody feud between the British government and the Provisional IRA, many more fatalities were to come. But the aftermath of such horrifying atrocities stretches beyond the incident itself, affecting friends and family far and wide. And although some injuries aren't always visible, unless help is sought to deal with the mental and emotional scars which linger underneath, other innocents may be hurt. And although they didn't die that day on South Carriage Drive, perhaps 4 more names should be added to the memorial. Michael, Erica, Ben, and Freya. The last victims of the Hyde Park bombing. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. As per usual, if you're a Murky Miler, stay tuned for more extra waffle after the break. But before that, here's my recommended podcast of the week, which are All Crime No Cattle and Simply Strange.
Hi, Hi, true crime fans. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay. We host All Crime, No Cattle, a conversational podcast which focuses on true crime stories from the Lone Star State.
We strive to bring you a balanced and well-researched story about Texas cases big and small.
We do the research so you don't have to.
We also end every episode with a good news story, just to remind everyone that real life isn't quite as depressing as true crime can make it out to be.
New episodes drop every Thursday, and you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. All Crime, No Cattle, because crime is bigger in Texas, y'all.
My name is PJ, and I host a show called Simply Strange. From cold cases to aliens, cryptids to ghost stories, every episode of Simply Strange is a storytelling experience that will take you on a journey through some of our world's darkest mysteries, putting you in the shoes of those who experienced them, while also attempting to uncover the truth behind the madness. So if you love thought-provoking stories that will disturb you to your core, and maybe make you check the closet before you turn the lights out, then I would like to cordially invite you to come check out Simply Strange at simplystrangepodcast.com, or just search Simply Strange wherever you listen to your podcasts, if you feel like it.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are Vivian, Meta Kongstead, and True Crime Nana, who get a regular dose of crime scene photos, videos, a weekly ebook, and shall become lucky recipients of some rather delightful Murder Mile goodies. Only available via Patreon. Sorry! A special thank you this week to Christine from Johnny and Eric of Cult With No Name, the geniuses who do most of the music for Murder Mile, as Christine came to see Cult With No Name play when they were at Farncombe. Christine, I'm glad you enjoyed them. They're really great, aren't they? A comment which was backed up by Philip Grundy, who, like myself, is hooked on their music, and rightly so. This week, I wanted to draw your attention to a new true crime book, which has hit our bookshops both online and in real life. Wow! It's a collection of fascinating and previously unheard true crime tales from Ben and Rosie of the fabulous They Walk Among Us podcast. If you love this podcast, and you should because it's amazing, here they bring you 10 new and previously untold true crime tales, which, like the podcast, are intricately researched and expertly told, in a thrilling, emotional, and unbiased way. There's a reason why this is one of the best true crime podcasts out there, and now they have a book. I've read it, I loved it, and I devoured it in 2 days. It's a cracking read, and a must for all true crime fans, and even better, for short-sighted people like myself. The text is actually in a decent size. But if reading isn't your thing, you can also get an audio version, as read by Benjamin. If you fancy treating yourself, I've popped a handy link in the show notes. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Woo-wee! That's that done. Good. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. It's me here. You know who I am. I don't need to introduce myself, do I? If I need to introduce myself at this point, it's kind of weird, isn't it? Because you've just listened to me for... That will probably be about half an hour, won't it? And now you'll be going, who is this man? It's me. It's Michael. Hello. Or Mike. I prefer Mike. I don't know why on this podcast I always call myself Michael. I hate being called Michael. Michael always feels like I'm in trouble. I don't really let variations. My mate Rusty, I let him call me Mick. He's one of the few people I let call me Mick. My brother's family, I let them call me Mickey. I haven't got a problem with that. Really, I hate being called Michael. And yet, on the tour and on the podcast, I call myself Michael. I don't know, maybe it's just to seem more professional. I don't know, but why does that make a difference between Mike and Michael? It's weird, isn't it? Why am I doing that? Anyway, this is Extra Mile. Hey folks, so I'm just going to see how long I've been doing. Right, okay, this is Extra Mile. For those who don't know, this is the extra bits. Afterwards, I'll give you some more insight into this story itself. We'll have a little bit of a waffle as well. I will go off and open my curtains. There's a tiny spider inside one of my curtains. I'm going to let him be. He's tiny, he's no harm to me. I'm just going to let him do what he needs to do. Opening all the curtains, familiar sound, opening the back doors. There's four locks on the door, top and bottom. Two at the top, two at the bottom. So I have to, there we go. I didn't actually end up locking them all. And that's the doors to the front of the boat. So now I can see out the front where I'm going to get some new covers very shortly. That'll be very nice. That's on Tuesday this week. So the next episode you hear, I will have new covers on the boat, which is very exciting. Costs me a lot of money, but got to be done. Now I do my usual thing of making a cuppa. This is me filling the kettle with a cup's worth of water from a water bottle. As I think I mentioned last time, I always like to keep my water pump off just in case I'm away, because the last thing you want is the boat to flood. It does happen. If you have 400 litres of water in your tank and then you... Where's my cup's here? I was going to say pass me my cup then, but you can't pass me my cup. If you have like 400 litres of water, it could do a lot of damage to the boat. You know, you could. So I deliberately make sure it's off. Why? Because I'm paranoid. Tea in there, bit of sugar. Got cube sugar today. Cube sugar. And yes, powdered milk. And because I've run out of biscuits, because I've run out of cake, because I've eaten all the cake, I've got all butter shortbread fingers. Made in Scotland. Baked to a traditional recipe for a buttery crumble. One finger is 5% of your daily intake of fat and 93 calories. God, do they know that I'm going to eat all of them? I'm going to eat every single one of those buggers. Oh, dear. Right, good. Hope you enjoyed that episode. A little bit different, that one. I think that's what I do, is when I go through the list of what we're doing episode-wise, I always try and make sure that they're always different. Always try and make sure that you don't have, like, next week there's not the same thing that's happening, because there's nothing worse. Also try to make sure, you know, if you don't have a stabbing this week, then a stabbing next week. Or it's kind of, I try and make it look very different. I try and get the eras different. I try and get the victims different. Motivations. So, you know, I often swap them around. I always do a list for myself of what the episode's going to be in advance. And then sometimes I when I've done an episode, I think to myself, next week's episode has a, you know, there might be a similarity to it. And I might say to myself, let's drop that back a bit. But this was one of those episodes where, I don't know whether I mentioned this last week. Maybe I did. I was kind of, I'd always wanted to do something on the Hyde Park and Regent's Park bombings. You know, they're both within the West End, and they're perfect for me to do, and I just didn't know how to do them, because, you know, it's important to get the emotional story in there, but there's a lot going on, there's a lot of different people, and there's a lot, and, you know, do you tell the terrorist story, or do you focus on one victim, or do you tell all the victims, or, you know, and I've been putting this off for a long time because I just didn't know how to tell the story. And then as I was researching it, I was like, I found out the story about Michael Peterson and his children, Ben and Freya, and his wife, Erica. And I was like, that's it. That's the story. But here, what I did was, I did it slightly different, where I deliberately made this kind of a third act. So, as with a lot of people, you know, a lot of people know a lot about the Hyde Park bombing and the Regent's Park bombing, but this is something that most people won't know, so that's why I've deliberately done it a kind of an intro at the start, introducing you to the politics and the tactics of the IRA, and then you focus on the bombing, and you focus on Michael Peterson and his horse Sefton, which I think makes a nice story, a bit of a juxtaposition, and about how they were injured, both mentally and physically, but they survived, and they became, like, big heroes and things like that, and then you have the other side of the story, which most people don't know about. I didn't know about this story at all. I was only whilst going through the archives, not the National Archives, because I couldn't get, you can't get access to this original file. Tease up, but it was, what I found out about it, it was basically just newspapers, really, I had to use for this one, because there's very little out there, there really is. It's weird, there's a hell of a lot of information about Sefton, the horse. Like, I can find out loads about Sefton, but trying to learn stuff about Michael Peterson's life is just, all you know about him really is his death. And the same with the kids as well. Luckily there was quite a few, this is the blessing sometimes, even though I do criticise newspapers, only because they're distant. If you think about it, like, a journalist during the day has probably three articles that they need to write that they have to get in by 4 o'clock. And what are they going to do if they get three news stories? Are they going to travel from, let's say, Wapping to Notting Hill to interview someone? Or are they just going to sit on their ass, read the AP Wire report, check Twitter for any other information about these people, and then write it themselves? They're not going to do it. Whereas the good thing is, there are some small local papers that I found in the area where Michael and Erica and Ben and Freya kind of lived. And those local papers were really good, because they, you know, they got time. They're not, this is a big news story for them. They got a chance. They knew the people. They got a chance to go out there, talk to the relatives. So I got a lot of information from, you know, people who were actual real neighbours. So those, sometimes those small newspapers are really, really useful. And, you know, you get a lot more personal information. So they're really good. It's just that the big tabloids that are a real problem. So, anyway, I'm ahead of myself. Where am I? Where am I? I'm heading north at the moment. We're still on the boat. It has been pissing it down for about 3 or 4 days, solid. I think they said that on Monday we had a month's rainfall in a day, and you could tell it was... So I'm on the canal at the moment. There's normally, on the bit I'm on, it's normally kind of the step up to get onto the canal, onto the towpath, is a... I said towpath. That sounded really posh. Maybe I'm turning into a posh person. The towpath, to get up to it, it's about 2 foot, but now it's even with the boat, so the water has risen about, I think, just over 2 foot. So it's quite high, but I think it's dropping at the moment. And my boat might be stuck on something. I'm going to check in a bit. But this can be quite a weird thing for boats. So if, like me, you live on a boat, it's not a problem. You kind of slacken your ropes. And to make sure that the boat moves with the water. It's kind of an important thing to do, not to have them too tight. Whereas you get quite a few people who we call boat dumpers. Or people who have cruiser boats, and that means that the back of their boat is slightly open, and that's where the engine is. And the problem is, you get water. My boat, there's nowhere for the water to go to. Everything's covered over. and it has vents. But if you have a cruiser boat, which is where the engine is, there's like a little back decking area underneath your engine. The rainwater can go into there, fill up the engine bay, and then your boat can start to sink. So over this week just gone, there's been a lot of boats already who have sunk. A, because they're probably ship boats, but B, because they're cruisers and the owners haven't come back. They've just been like, oh, I'm too busy at my girlfriend's house watching Game of Thrones. And then they come back and go, where's my boat sunk? So, but it's nice. I love the rain. It's quite nice at night. You can sit there because it's a steel roof. When it's raining, even with light rain, you can hear it kind of pitter-pattering. It's really nice. It's very relaxing to go to sleep to. Update. I can't remember which episode I recorded here last time. I've recorded a few here before. But I think last time I was here, I may have mentioned that there were some lovely white geese with orange beaks. There's like a family of five of them that go up and down. Sadly, no longer five. There's now three. There's a big sign on the lock. There's a lock next to me, and a big, big sign on it saying, don't let the geese down through the lock. Because there's swans down there, and the swans are very aggressive, and they will kill the geese. Unfortunately, one got killed, and there's a sign that says one has been blinded, but it looks like that one passed away as well. So sad news. No coots here though. No coots. I know. Oh well. Oh no. There was some what are they called? Egyptian geese. They're kind of the nice sandy coloured ones, and they're a family of them down there. They got five little baby Egyptian geese, and they were really sweet. Anyway, that's kind of your coot update bit. Merch update. I know, shameless advertising. Just to let you know, I've updated the merch shop a little bit on the website. So now you can get all of the Blackout Ripper scripts all in one ebook, which is very nice. I've just got a load of mugs come in. No sweets. I stopped doing the mugs with sweets because they're a nightmare. And also, as I mentioned last time, it puts it over the weight bracket. So you end up paying, if you're in America, you end up paying £2 more because I've put in the equivalent of like £1 worth of sweets. So it doesn't make sense. So I've stopped putting sweets in it now because it keeps it under half a kilo, and therefore you're paying less money, which is all good. You can buy sweets online. That's fine. So we've got loads of new mugs, got badges, got Murky Miler badges. You can get tickets to Murder Mile. You can book them as tickets to any tour. That's every Sunday at 11 o'clock. You can book private tours. You can book it as vouchers. So for anyone you think might like Murder Mile, you can go, oh, I'll buy you a gift voucher. Gift vouchers, they stay valid for about a year. And if you want t-shirts, underneath there on the merch page, there's a little link for if you want to design t-shirts or bags with a Murder Mile logo. You can design whatever you like. It's quite good. It's the logo's up there. You just decide whatever you want. And some people have, and that's really brilliant. Just a quick thank you to Sue Elliott and Andy. I went to my PO box in town and opened it up, and there was the usual shit from the tax man and other such arseholes. But thankfully, very kind of them, Sue and Andy had sent me some lovely emergency rations to keep me going. And there were just loads and loads of goodies full of marzipan and franzipan, all the things I love. So thank you so much to Sue and Andy. Yum. They've all gone. Yes, they've all disappeared. I know you'll be listening to this in about 2 weeks' time or whatever, but this is like 5 or 6 days after I received the parcel. It's all gone. All of it. Every single thing. Yum. Thought we'd give you a series update. Don't worry, this is not a bad series update. This is not me going, oh god, I can't cope. As you know, what I'm trying to do is not burn myself out like last time. I've learnt my lessons about being the threat of being sued as well. Spoke to a good friend during the week, is producer of documentaries. Sat down with him, really good bloke, I've known him for years, and he was very helpful in kind of giving me advice, saying, you know, your research is good, but also it's almost impossible to sue someone. And also there was, what was your name? It wasn't Vicky, was it? What was your name? You were with Kit. We were on the tour last week. I don't think you actually listened to the podcast anyway, but I know that Kitran does. Your friend who was with you was very useful. Is she a lawyer? I'm not too sure. But she was saying about how difficult it is to actually sue someone, and that you've got to prove loss as well, which is a very difficult thing to do, which was really useful. So that, you know, that's helped take the fear away from me. It doesn't mean that I can start calling people assholes, which I'd never do. I always deliberately write and research these in a very compassionate way, and I treat everyone with respect. And if someone is a killer, I try and use as much of their original statements as possible. And I know that sometimes families do come forward. As I've mentioned before, like, some families have come forward and said, this is amazing, you did a great job, it was very detailed, it's nice to hear it done in a very sensitive but a very articulate and detailed way. Sometimes families come forward and go, you are a big fat liar, who the fuck do you think you are? But what I've realised over time is that, because I have access to the files, I know more than they do. Families do not have access to police files, and rightfully so, because they would just tear it up, they would rip it up. Because it's things that they don't want to know about their family. So I'm conscious of that, therefore I write it in a very sensitive way. Whew. But, as you know, so I'm trying not to burn myself out with doing too many episodes. These episodes still are taking about 6 to 7 days a week to do, and that's weekly, and it's still tiring. But what I'm trying to do is space it, try and make it not too, so there's not too many, and keep myself ahead of the schedule as well. I'm trying to keep myself up. I think I'm about a week ahead at the moment. I'd like to be 2 weeks ahead. Because, as you know, both my mum and my gran have dementia. Mum's in Birmingham, gran's in Scotland. I'm gran's carer. They're both old and on the decline. So I'm trying to make myself available. I guess go and see them, but I try and make myself available when things crop up, and things do crop up. But what I want to do is make sure that, you know, there's not a gap in Murder Mile, or that I come back to it and I go, oh shit, oh, I'm behind. I don't want to start panicking myself about getting an episode out. And I know that you guys will be fine with that if there's no episode. But so what I'm trying to do is keep a consistency with Murder Mile, but without putting myself under too much pressure to kind of force out episodes. Also, if I force them out, that lowers the quality. So Mini Mile will be coming back very soon. I really enjoyed doing those. Those were the kind of the fun, sketchy versions, more the factual end. They're very good. Danielle has very kindly agreed to help me with some of the research for that, so that's really good. So I've got a little bit of help there, which is great. And I will be, I think I'm going to do like another 3 or 4 episodes of Mini Mile. And then, because I've got a week up at my gran's, or not a week, but a good couple of days, where I've got to sort some stuff out, I'm going to put out an episode. But I'm going to try something different for that week, I think. What I'm going to do is a kind of a walk through Soho. So I've got my new recorder, my new posh recorder, that I was going to use to record the other shows that I was planning earlier on. They're not going to happen anymore, but this is kind of an idea that I was toying with. So what it'll be is I'll do a walk through Soho, just a casual walk. And as we pass locations, because there's loads, like I might just pick one street and I'll just focus on one street and just tell you all the stories that I can see on that street and explain the stories to you. And that will be kind of more like Murder Mile was meant to be at the start. When I first did the Denmark Place fire, originally that idea was going to be that I was going to stand on the street, which is why on the stories that I go today, I'm standing on da-da-da. Episode one, I stood on Denmark Street, and I was like, today I'm on Denmark Street. And because my dyslexia can be quite bad sometimes, because I'm easily distracted, because, you know, noises happen in wrong places, and you know, if you're in Soho, like, you'll be in the middle of a story and someone will come up to you and go, oh mate, you got any spare change? Oh, what's that you're doing? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you're on a podcast, can I be on a podcast as well? What's a podcast? And I was just like, it would be impossible to edit anything like that, which is why I do all the sounds in post-production afterwards. And it also makes it for a cleaner story anyway. But what I'm going to do is try and do just part of it, do an intro to that, to see how it would have sounded. It would sound awful, but anyway, so I'll be doing one of those. So that'll be like a walkthrough of Soho. It'll be easy to produce. I can do it in about a day. That means it gives me 6 days back. Blackbird is out there today. That blackbird has been really noisy this morning. That gives me about 6 days back, which is good. It gets me on track. And if people like it, it's something that I can start doing every so often. So it's kind of like, I don't want you to get bored. I think that's the problem, is sometimes some of my favorite podcasts, it's the same every week. And because Murder Mile does have a formula, I don't want you to kind of go, oh, it's the same story again. Oh, I've heard this kind of thing. If we have some Murder Mile episodes, some singles, and then you've got your multi-parters, and then we've got Extra Miles, standalone episodes, and then you've got Mini Mile, and then we've got these new walkthroughs. I don't know what, I might just call it the walkthrough. Or maybe it'll be something else, something related to not Extra Mile, not Mini Mile. Maybe it is a, I don't know, something mile related. No, maybe I'll just call it a walkthrough. Get away from the, yeah. Anyway, I'm talking to myself now. That's really weird. Cup of tea. Lovely. Bit of PG. So I've got loads of things to add. I'm doing a new blog every week. Hopefully I'm going to try and do it weekly. What I'm doing is Q&As, so question and answer sessions with true crime podcasters who are out there. It's kind of a chance for true crime podcasters to promote themselves, but I've written a range of questions that I think are quite interesting, and it gives them a chance to kind of answer those questions and for you to get a chance to kind of have a look at it and go, oh, I might give that a go. It sounds interesting. So that's going onto my blog as well. If you've not checked out my blog, please do. It's on murdermiletools.com/blogs. There's a link in the show notes. Every week I put up a video of the location, so you can see how this video looks. There's a map that I'm currently sorting out, but it shows you where it is in relation to everything else. Because I take a lot of the photos myself, there's some photos on there that are show the location and other things. Sometimes it's like the original crime scene photos, things like that. They're posted on there. You get them on Patreon. I give them to all my Patreon subscribers early because, their money helps keep Murder Mile alive, which is great. So they get everything early. But as the episode goes out, if you go onto my blog, there'll be some of the photos on there, not all of them, because I can only put up the ones that I've taken myself or are license free. Otherwise, I get fined again. I was in breach of copyright infringement about 3 years ago, and even though I had probably 300 or 400 photos on my website which weren't mine, I got them off Google, just done image search, and done. You can't do that, not allowed to do that. If you have a website and you have images on there that you don't own the rights to or are license free, you have to be really careful. I had one photo where I'd used a tiny piece of one photo, and they were like, right, that'll be £60. In total, four photos, I was charged almost £350 just for using them on a blog. And I was like, but no one's going to see this blog. And they were like, we don't care, it's our photos. So you have to be really, really careful about what photos you use. You can use them on Facebook, that's not a problem. Instagram, Twitter, not a problem. There's no rules protecting that at the moment. You can share what you like. But if you have a blog, you have to be really... If you've got any photos on there, just go in there and just rip them all out. Otherwise, you are in shit. Right. Hope that was helpful. Right. Okay. Let's do some details about this story. Because I've just... Oh, that was a lot of waffle, that was. Don't worry, I don't have much to say about this. Because I've pretty much used everything in the story. One thing that I took out of the story, I briefly mentioned it. They know that the Hyde Park bomb was triggered by remote, and that a member of the IRA would have been stood in the park, probably by one of the trees. Actually, it would make more sense if he was on the main road, because then he could drive away. Probably was by the road. They don't know where he was. They never saw him, but it would make sense that he was on the Kensington Road. That would make sense. The person who detonated the bomb must have known that there was a woman and the baby, in a pram who were in the field at the time of the blast. Now, even though they'd said the IRA had said that they were going to do military targets only, there were people there, and there was a woman with a pram. They both survived. The woman was struck in the leg by an unknown object. It could have been shrapnel from the car, or it could have been one of the projectiles. She passed out. Luckily, the baby was unhurt. Unhurt. I just said unhersh. That's nothing, whatever that word is. There were some quotes by friends and family saying that Michael was very controlling. His final control over Erica was the children, but you never expect this. He is meant to have loved the kids. Other neighbour said he only just recently moved out. They were going to divorce. Friends added that the couple had split up because Mr. Peterson had been impossible to live with. They'd been married for over 10 years, but he had recently been living separately in Chertsey. Chertsey. I always thought Chertsey was fictional. I don't know why. It's because I remember hearing it in The Young Ones years ago, and I always thought Chertsey and Surbiton were fictional places. I thought they were invented for sitcoms because it sounds funny and it sounds fictional, but Surbiton and Chertsey are real places. Sorry to anyone who lives in Surbiton and Chertsey. One of Michael's business pals claimed that the father of four, he had two children with his first wife and two with his second wife, that he had said, "She'll pay for this." That was just 72 hours before the killings happened. Now, I didn't put that in the story because that can't be corroborated. That's one of those kind of phrases that people often say after someone has been murdered by someone else. Do you know, the press come to them and they go, "Oh, yeah, oh, he said, oh, she'll pay for this." But, you know, did it really happen? Did it not happen? We don't know. So, when the police arrived, they cordoned off the area while scenes of crimes officers inspected the crime scene. Detective Superintendent Tony Harris of Hampshire Police said, "We are currently investigating the circumstances surrounding this terrible incident and are working to establish what has led to these tragic deaths." They'd only been there a short while, but already they were saying, "We are treating this as an isolated incident and we do not believe anyone else was involved." So they could see exactly what had happened, that it was, you know, Michael had murdered Ben and Freya and then had stabbed himself with a knife. Families of Ben Freya, families of Michael, Ben and Freya have been informed, and specialist family liaison officers from the Hampshire Constabulary and officers from the Surrey Police, because it was on the border, are working with, it was on the border, but obviously the families, Michael went to see his grandfather in Hampshire, but they lived in Surrey. That's why there's two constabularies working at the same time. Are working with them to provide support and keep them up to date as the investigation progresses. I didn't go into the trial to do with who did the bombing, the Hyde Park bombing, because it just made it really messy, and I really didn't want this to focus on the bombing itself. This was really about post-traumatic stress disorder and Michael Peterson and his family. Really just Ben and Freya, but how the events led to that. So I didn't focus on the bombing at all. But, just in case you wanted to know, in October 1987, 27-year-old Gilbert McNamee from County Armagh, oh God, my jaw just cracked, from County Armagh, was sentenced at the Old Bailey to 25 years in prison for his role in the Hyde Park bombings and others, they say. That means Regent's Park, and that would be Chelsea as well. In December 1998, shortly after his release from May's prison under the Good Friday Agreement, three Court of Appeal judges quashed his conviction, deeming it unsafe because of withheld fingerprint evidence that implicated other bomb makers. They stated that though the conviction was unsafe, it did not mean McNamee was necessarily innocent of the charge. On the 19th of May 2013, 61-year-old John Anthony Downey of County Donegal was charged with murder in relation to the Hyde Park bomb and intended to cause an explosion likely to endanger life. He appeared by video link from Belmarsh Prison for a bail hearing at the Old Bailey on the 24th of May and did not apply for bail, so was remanded in custody. At a hearing on the 1st of August 2013, I've got to get that right, Downey was granted conditional bail and a trial has been scheduled for January 2014. 2014, he entered a not guilty plea on four murder charges and the charge of intending to cause an explosion. On the 25th of January, same year, the trial collapsed as the judge had ruled on the 1st of February, upon a letter sent to the police service of Northern Ireland to Downey in 2007. Assuring him that he would not face criminal charges over the attack. Although the assurance was made in error, the police made police realised the mistake. It was never withdrawn, and the judge ruled that therefore the defendant had been misled, and prosecuting him would be an abuse of executive power. Downey was one of 187 IRA suspects who received secret on the run letters, guaranteeing them official, unofficial immunity from prosecution. Whew, sorry, that was a bit of a mouthful there. So far, no one has been charged for the Hyde Park and the Regent's Park bombings. Even though evidence shows that Gilbert Danny McNamee, his fingerprints were on the bomb, and who's his other tosspot? John Anthony Towney. So we'll probably never know. We'll probably never know who did it, but I think we can guess. So that was that. Hope you enjoyed that. That was episode 64. That's all good. I'm going to end it there. I'm going to have my cup of tea. I'm going to start editing this. I want to get this done by tomorrow, hopefully. And then I can plough on with the next episode. So that was episode 64. Hope you enjoyed that. I'm having a stretch. I'm having a cup of tea and I'm going to have a shortbread. Have yourself a good day. Be good. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.